bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things, our special Before Things episode. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
I'm ashamed to admit it, how long it took me to understand that gag. It'll make sense to you guys at home soon.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
I think I get it, but I'm like a switchboard operator. I'm trying to connect A to B.
If I could guess, the subject of today's episode is where were we 10 years ago? Because just before we went live with this episode, we were talking about the fact that the podcast is just barely over 10 years old. As a matter of fact, 10 years and month and a half ago, we did the live Houdini seance, which, by the way, nailed it. Totally contacted Houdini. Just write that check out to weirdthings.gov. A lot has changed over the last 10 years of us doing this. A lot of things we learned as independent entrepreneurs that we thought it would be fun to sort of break down and deconstruct.
Yeah. So I figure we could dive into each one of us. We want to share with something like what's changed considerably. And I'll start off and say that, like, 10 years ago, a good part of my income was made through, like, magic videos and books and stuff. And I watched as YouTube grew and other distribution platforms grew, I knew that was going to reach its expiration date. I knew that digital content is, you know, paying for digital content like that was going to reach an end. That wasn't going to be the way it was going to continue in the future. And you've seen that now where your bigger magic creators or magic presenters, people like Brian and stuff, were people who built up channels in those methods and means. And so I certainly saw the writing on the wall 10 years ago, like, oh, this is, I'm not going to be able to do what I've been doing before. And everything has its run. And I was very lucky to be part of a really good run of that. And that's when I started thinking about what was going to be next. And that ended up being books. And, you know, I've talked a lot about this with friends about how I got into writing books for as an indie and then a published author, but I started in 2011 and that role doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, my biggest thing I'd say now is that how much the algorithm matters, not in the whole like Google searchable sort of thing, but as far as how recommendations are made towards other people, how do you get other people to recommend you to whatnot? And particularly with books, it's really about the Amazon algorithm. And, you know, I don't know. I certainly think that YouTube has its version, and Brian could speak about that, how recommendation works there. But word of mouth is really important on some platforms. Algorithms are more important on other ones. And the ones that I'm in when it comes to publishing, I think that the word of mouth is absolutely critical, but it is the algorithm that really is going to make the biggest difference.
So 10 years ago, there was no Andrew Main, the novelist. And now here we are with a multiple award winning, best-selling novelist, Andrew Main. 10 years ago, Justin, was there political guru, pundit, commentator extraordinaire, historian, Justin Robert Young?
Indeed there was, and he operated exclusively in Andrew Main's car, where we would just talk about politics to and from the Arby's. For Andrew, this is an unbroken decade of me having constant political opinions, but it certainly took half that intervening time before I started recording it and putting it out to others.
And the other half of it was me telling story ideas to Justin that it's just like, yeah, just write it, for Christ. Just write it. And that was the car ride to be politics. Like, oh, I have an idea for this. Da 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 da. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that was, I mean, if we really want to be honest, especially for me, you know, the beginning of the decade was still working with Andrew and us having a million different ideas, trying a billion different things, and some of them being more successful than others. But the biggest thing that changed was me obviously leaving Florida, coming out to California, focusing more on the podcast stuff. And that is now the career. And to be totally honest, what the lessons that were learned at the beginning of the decade, which, you know, at times could be hard because there were projects for which we put everything that we could, you know, in terms of emotions and work ethic and stuff like that, that, you know, wound up falling through for one reason or another, either because of stuff that we did or stuff that was out of our hands. And then realizing that, you know, that's the actual life of a creator. The actual life of a creator is watching 98% of the really rad ideas you have, you know, totally fall apart. And then the other parts are understanding what success is. Yeah, Jesus. Now we're going back to 10 years ago. This was the first episode I ever did of what is now Jury Daily. But it was just a live stream out of my room in Margate, Florida, where I had set up this little set. And that wound up begetting politics, politics, politics. And now that is the primary, that is the biggest podcasting thing that I make money on is PX3.
Where were you, Bryce, 10 years ago?
10 years ago, that would be 2009, I would have been in my second year. At VCU.
Like going to college, not in teaching college.
not teaching. though I did in my, I don't know if it was my junior year or my senior year, I did do a few like one-off like lecture-y type teaching things. So like, because I did a lot of sound stuff in college, and so I would teach people how to use Ableton, and because nobody else knew how to use it, but a lot of people wanted to use it because it was very music focused. So that would have been before I had even started my first podcast. That would have been around the time that I was finding the NSFW show, and so it wouldn't be, I think, until 2011. I think it would have been 2011 or 2012 that I started my first podcast, which was a 4-night-a-week live streamed on Justin.tv and then put out on a podcast feed. It was a mix of things. So like a couple of days would be like current events or current topics, and then one day would be a game, and then one day would be a picks day, like Weird Things, because I had liked I liked that in Weird Things. So one day we would just talk about stuff that we liked. And I did that for about 9 months.
When did you do the Kickstarter for your first album?
That was right before I moved out here. That would have been about 5 years ago. And that was actually my second album. It was my first one that I've majorly published, or I guess majorly self-published. But yeah, it was a Kickstarter at the time. That's 5 years ago, because that was right before I got here. And it's funny, my brother, this is nothing, but my brother's first kid was born. I remember it, the night that she was born was the night I finally got the artwork back from the artist who made the cover design for the album. And so she is basically as old as that Kickstarter campaign is now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But yeah, and in terms of like how stuff has changed, like streaming has changed a lot. Live streaming has changed. Recording technologies have changed. I remember having to set up on my big, I had this big like 18-inch laptop to set up the stream, and I would have to, there's a program called Virtual Audio Cable, which I think is still around, that you would say, okay, plug this thing into this thing, and I would have to run it. I'd have to have like 12 different instances running at the same time, because I needed to run everything different places. But you also couldn't like set up an automation. So you'd have to like every time spend an hour setting up all of the different things and making sure they were right.
By the way, I love the fact that what you're describing is the difficulties of making sure a bunch of virtual devices get along while in the background of your shot is a big, fat, gigantic physical example of taking that to the next level.
Yeah, I mean, that's... in fact, thinking about it, I think we can actually expand some of that stuff using very similarly virtual audio cable. So, like, in some ways, some of that stuff hasn't changed too much, but we've seen that stuff grow out more, right? The need for virtual audio stuff. I mean, voice meter, which is something that we use as a component of our setup here, is like a big thing in terms of like. Streaming people, streaming stuff is a big thing. Games, podcasts, music, arts, whatever. That's a big thing. There are more services than ever. I mean, every week there's some story about some service making these deals with these content creators to keep them exclusive to their platforms. And I think maybe the household nameness of them will probably continue to go down and down. It will be more and more people who... not everyone will know, but I think you'll probably see more deals like that and more content deals.
Sorry, you're talking about content deals that are tied to specific platforms?
Yeah, like Twitch or Mixer, right? I mean, Ninja famously a few months ago got signed to Mixer. There was a thing this past week of a bunch of other big name streamers sticking to Twitch, announcing staying on Twitch. And it's almost like a sports contract negotiation of like, I'm sticking with this team. It's kind of a team-based thing in that regard.
That's interesting because Justin and Andrew and I have talked for years about what it was wild to be one of the last generations to grow up in the monoculture where there were only three channels and everybody knew the same things or whatever. And I think right under our noses over the last 10 years, we saw a brief moment of, and maybe YouTube will pull it off and continue to be a monoculture, but kind of YouTube was a monoculture, and now, through threats of Twitch and spins off and all that stuff, I wonder if we're going to see more splintering.
I kind of disagree, although you are more plugged into YouTube than I am. But when I watched that YouTube year in review thing, which they totally punted on because the last one was so poorly received, it just seemed like I knew a fraction of stuff that for other people, I'm assuming that's their whole world. Right. Like that there is
YouTube is big. It can't be considered a monoculture because it has its own
monoculture. Yeah. I mean, that's like saying like, oh, well, television is still a monoculture because that's the delivery method. But
there's also 700 TV channels now.
Yeah. Because it's like I don't care about K-pop, but yet it is the dominant thing on Twitter. It is the dominant thing on YouTube in terms of like all available metrics of what really moves the needle. Now, eventually will we find kind of like sub monocultures? Will there be some other way that like now we gather together more as like city states? Who knows? Yes. I mean, you could say that arguably we're kind of doing that now without directions from one kind of like Tower of Babel, but it is to me a continuing splintering of things. The only thing that changes is the money, because like all these defections are staying with Twitch and stuff like that on streaming. That's literally just all about cash. That's about other companies, be they Google or Facebook or Microsoft, saying we want to get in on this. How would you like a gigantic pile of cash for a few years?
And I think that's the big. The big change, especially in whether it's streaming or online video, has been focusing on paying creators up front instead of being these flat, planes for everybody, right? Like whether it's a YouTube original, whether it's you're getting a Mixer stream, like even outside of the like AdWords style or like Twitch partner, semi-automated steps to have a money transaction with these companies. We're also seeing more very public deals to keep creators and content at certain places. A la Netflix, or I'm basically saying like the thing that we're seeing with Netflix originals being very public about exclusivity, we're seeing more and more and more of that.
Well, you know, what remains to be seen will be of a lot of these platforms which are launching is what happens 3 or 4 years from now. Because right now, a lot of the money being paid to get people to go there is the investor money because they're trying to build it out. And we'll see if there becomes which ones will become sustainable economies or ecosystems, which is going to be we're going to have another upheaval, you know, because you're going to get people who are going to pay to go over to platform B or whatever. But then 2 years from now, platform B runs out of money and either do they go to the other platform or they go back to YouTube. And I just want to touch on something. Did you just say you're not a fan of K-pop, Justin?
Well, I mean, I don't follow K-pop. I mean, consider myself.
I'm just wondering who I saw dressed up aside from Gangnam Style at Dragon Con.
I mean, sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess I am aware of it as much as anybody else would be. And indeed, I did learn the dance steps to Gundam Style as well. But I have not. I guess that would be pretty much my peak of being aware of K-pop, this global phenomenon known as that song, because I am not, I guess, I am not familiar.
Understood.
So it's like, yes, I know Achy Breaky Heart, but I would not consider myself a country music fan.
Did you ever see the remake he did of that?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Although, hell, you know, we can all laugh about Billy Ray Cyrus, except for the fact that he had the number one single in the year of our Lord 2019.
That's right. He was on Old Town Road.
Yep. That's a fun song. It's interesting because you see where everybody thinks things are going, you know, where people, you know, we think this is where the thing is going to be and where we want to try to be. And sometimes you're right. Sometimes, you know, the trend is there. But it can be, you know, exhausting trying to chase after things. I think the things that worked out best for me were just sort of following through, like, I got into writing because of the platform that opened up with the Kindle, you know, with the idea of self-publishing. I got into it because of that. Once that platform was there, I got onto it. It wasn't like I felt like, oh, I have to do this now because now it's early. I just was like waiting for this opportunity. And I think that for a lot of people, like, you know, Brian doing YouTube shows and stuff like that, it wasn't like, you know, I don't think Brian's like, ah, this is where the gold mine is. I think you're saying like, hey, I like to entertain. I like to do this. I'd like to be on camera.
Yeah, and to be honest, in the very beginning, we're going a little bit beyond the 10-year window, but when I first started doing YouTube, it was, as I've said many times, it was after a failed pitch for Court TV that I realized, oh, wait, I have to have on-screen experience. I have to have something I could point to that shows that I know what I'm doing. I have to be bad before I can become good, as we've talked about. And I always thought it was a middle step. Never occurred to me that YouTube would be the thing. And
YouTube wasn't the thing at first, right? I mean, for Scam School, at least months.
No. For quite a while, there was that hot minute that Revision 3 thought they were competing with YouTube, and why would we host our stuff on that platform? And of course, you know, they became an MCN, and a lot of other stuff changed over the years. The biggest transformation for me that happened over the last 10 years was I was pretty much at the peak of being booked at college shows and trying to wedge in that dead bandwidth in between shows, just, you know, whatever something extra experience I could do to reach more people. And I thought I was doing it in service of getting more shows booked, but it turned out that as I've said before, I thought I was getting in front of more people for the purposes that I could find one person to give me $1,000 for a show. And ultimately, over the last 10 years, I came to understand when we launched Scam Stuff in 2012, that my real job should be to get 1,000 people to give me $1. And so we were able to create, you know, content originals. We were able to reach out and, I can't think of a better word than harvest goodwill, but it sounds so mercenary when you put it that way. But basically to translate that goodwill into ways that that create a finance engine that funds all of the creative content that we do here. And so that was, I'm surprised that it took me so long into that 10-year experience, 3.5 years before I really figured it out, to figure out that it's important to build an engine to finance everything that allows the content to exist for the content's own sake.
You know, when Justin and I were working on our first TV pilot, which was actually it was for MTV when we shot that with the production company in Orlando. YouTube had just launched, you know, and you know, that was a sort of, cause like our phase at that point was, you knew the internet was big, but there wasn't like the one place or thing that you would do, you know?
Actually, you want to know what? And this memory just came flooding back. We were scouting a bar that had, oh my God, just a hilariously, you know, talking about everything going wrong, shoot that next night, but we were scouting that bar. And I remember looking up at the TV behind the bar, and it was a story about how YouTube had been acquired by Google.
Wow.
We were in the middle of shooting that when that acquisition happened. And I remember talking with Andrew about, you know, just all the reasons why it made perfect sense. And it's funny, 10 years ago when we were having this conversation, more than 10 years ago, that the operative question that we were trying to answer is, well, yeah, so, you know, YouTube doesn't make money, but I'm sure with the bandwidth that they're going to have with Google, they'll probably make money. And even now, there seems to be a question of like, what does YouTube make money? there's a lot of money going through. Like, how much actually at the end?
Yeah, I think it is weird that we haven't seen a major major video on demand competitor to YouTube in the way that, like, overnight Imgur took over PhotoBucket and YFrog and ImageFlip and all these other like ad laden bad experiences, and it's weird to like see Imgur today where it is kind of bloated in the same way that those services were, right? With,
oh yeah, as a matter of fact,
stuff, ad stuff.
Imgur, of course, was built on the back of a lot of traffic and goodwill from Reddit crowds,
right?
Because it made it very easy to host and access video or photo and eventually video content. But now, ironically, as I scroll through Reddit and I click on a picture that looks like it'll be interesting, if it's not hosted on Reddit, sends me not to the picture, but to the Imgur app that tells me, yeah, I should sign up.
I have blah, to get blah, blah. I had to get rid of the Imgur app because it would lose. It wouldn't even link right.
And I hate it. I hate it. I won't. I whatever that is, I'm like, I'm sure it's a fine but photo, whatever know, that was. And it, then I leave.
It's splintered from Reddit in that way, right? All the community, like Imgur, has its own upvoting system. It has. I mean, people will just go to the Imgur app, and that's their Reddit, basically.
Well, and also, Imgur has created their own. It's basically a blogging service now, which brings us to another gigantic trend over the last 10 years, which is what I started out. The beginning of this decade as a blogger. You know, that's how I spent most of my day. Most of my day was figuring out exactly what I was going to be writing about, either with Magic or with Weird Things. And that kind of went away. I mean, the idea of, you know, blogging has changed so much. And the biggest thing was we saw the absolute peak and then the slow destruction of the blog networks. You know, back in the aughts were thought to be like, well, you know, like these names, you know, they seem stupid now, but, you know, plus 30 years, they're going to be as revered as the New York Times or, I mean, maybe even the New York Post or something like that with a little bit more of an irreverent tone. But man, a lot of these are gone, and many of them have been subsumed into other companies. You've seen the vultures descend on some of the name values on them, but boy, that blogging revolution was a quick burn.
I think we've talked a lot about this off the show, but is how much Facebook and Twitter devastated that. Just not through any sinister sort of thing, but just as far as if you were going to post something, first you did it on the blogs, but then as Facebook started reaching more like, I guess I should post it on Facebook too. And then you're kind of like, a lot of people are like, why am I posting on my blog? Nobody goes there. And then we paid that price.
Yeah. No, when all the content clicks went to Facebook and Facebook was like, come on in, we can connect you with your audience. You'll have all these great insights. This is the future. Like look at this amazing social graph. You know, we just helped elect Obama because he's super smart. Come on in. And then everybody did. And then click. And you realize
they
that
the put the chain on the door.
And you're like, what did we do?
Can I talk about what I think is a thing that we'll see more of in 10 years from now?
Ooh, yeah, speculation.
So
tell me where to invest, Bryce. Tell me where to invest.
So have we talked about Coil before?
No.
So Coil is a payment platform. So the way that they have it set up now, but they are built on a bunch of standards that are more open and people could basically make their own, is you pay $5 a month for a Coil subscription, whatever.
One of these.
And create, and so it's a plugin. It's a plugin for your web browser. So the time that people spend on your website or on your video, say, that turns into money for that creator. So you might say, okay, here's my blog. You are reading my blog. The time that you spend on my blog, you can even look at the thing and it ticks up like fractions of a cent or cents. And then you, by having that subscription, you can open up like, oh, here are the exclusive videos. Here are the version. Here's the version of this video without ads. I was a little hesitant on it, but a few months ago, maybe close to 6 months now, Imgur and Coil have a partnership because Imgur kind of needs to work on their monetization strategy, and it's very tough to monetize images because you can just screenshot anything. And so having a system like this, which is basic, which would is very similar to like a it's a user pay system, kind of like a Patreon. If it's based on how much time you spend on an app, I think that there's something here.
It sounds like a proto version of what I've wanted desperately, which is basically cable for news sites, where it's like, don't make me sign up for each of your individual newspapers and magazines and all that stuff. Just let me get charged micropayments for however much I eat of whatever it is you have. Right. And no pop-ups, no none of that stuff.
And so my understanding, so the web monetization is part of this, is the name of the spec that they use. And I think it's open enough that people, if you wanted to, you could go and build your own version of this. But this is already hooked into, there's a blockchain element so that payment processes and small payments make sense without a million processing fees. But I think it's really interesting, especially as we keep getting further and further into a space where people don't want to see ads. They would rather support a thing, or we can keep pumping more ads into stuff to replace the fact that ads are either less effective or something like this might show up. So I would not be surprised if, like in your example, Brian, there was some sort of like, hey, we own all of these newspapers. Here's our publishing company's Coil for that.
Well, here's the problem, is that nobody wants to undercut how they're making money now. And right now, the newspaper industry, which, I mean, for people who are purveyors of the first draft of history, boy, are they bad at understanding their own history and how terrible they are with technological evolutions, because they can only see 6 inches in front of their face. And that's been the case for the past 3 decades. I'd be shocked if they did this. Brian's dream of the like, hey, just pay this one thing and maybe we can all share from it, is right now remote, until newspaper clicks die down, which is being driven by one very controversial vertical right now. Eventually that will calm down and you will see the natural trend lines of these things kind of, I think, revert back to the mean a little bit. And at that point, maybe this is a situation where you're like, okay, if I'm spending time on this, then I'm paying money into it. But the problem that newspapers are facing is similar to what we were talking about earlier with Facebook. They're always fighting the last war. And the last war for them was, we gave up everything to Facebook. We took their stupid money so we could build little mini sites on there. We fed them all of our users. We gave them all of our content. We counted on them for clicks, and all they did was alter the deal and tell us, pray we don't alter it any further.
Yeah.
And so now...
not only did they alter the deal, they sent us a bill for it. We were like, great. Oh, yeah. You got to write a little bit.
And so now they are, and I'm specifically talking about the vanguard of this movement, which is the New York Times and the Washington Post, they won't give up their direct relationship with users for anybody. Mm-hmm. They will not. They are, because that's the lesson that they learned, is never trust anybody, especially anybody from Silicon Valley. Never trust them. They're only going to get us into this thing, and they're going to make us dependent on them. And then they're going to make it more costly, which is why, you know, even somebody like Apple, which had under Steve Jobs the reputation of being able to bring together the big deal because they have a certain brand, they're going to make sure that the money's right. The New York Times, the Washington Post didn't want to do it. And now Apple News, their subscription service, the Apple subscription service, is kind of DOA because of it.
Yeah.
I think I'm excited whenever somebody wants to try something like Coil, and there's a few other sites that are trying to come up with monetization schemes. And I want us to keep coming up with ideas, people to keep doing that. But you know, every time I see one of these, though, you look at it like, okay, how will people game this system? Because the hardest problem of doing any kind of commerce on the internet is fraud. And that's why PayPal got an early start and spent a tremendous amount of startup capital preventing fraud in order to get where they are. Google, what they have to do to avoid click fraud. Remember, click fraud was such a huge thing, and it was just an arms race. And so, you know, you see a site like this where it's like, you know, people figured out how to game Spotify with like fake album names and stuff like that. And that's the thing that, you know, whenever I talk to people who are working on stuff like this, is like, what are you going to do for fraud? Because that's what kills these systems, where, you know, you have sincere content creators and somebody else figures out like, oh, time on the site, great, I can do this. I can develop a little, you know, JavaScript pop-up that sits up behind the browser and it's going to stay there for longer. And you get all these sort of things, which they're not reasons to not do it, but you want to know that they're paying the right attention and not just hand-waving away, you know, the fraud aspect. But
yeah, there are definitely problems to a time spent as a metric for value, because that values long or lower quality content that you can pump out much, much more of, versus if you have a good 10-minute read, once a month, you know, like, absolutely, like, this is, but I think something like this, I wouldn't be surprised to see, like, with the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, the Washington Post and the New York Times, like you mentioned, Justin, like, that's because those are kind of monolithic, structures, where I think if you had someone who was like a local newspaper, and you know, all the local newspapers are owned by one company, they can, maybe they have something like this where there's a semi-network element.
I think that there's a room for something like this. Now, Andrew's point is, I think the operative phrase here, because anything that is created on the internet that is working as seamless as possible is at tremendous risk for a constantly increasing, like, a machine learning threatened fraud. Mm-hmm. As far as newspapers go, the one thing I would say is, if the phrase in the next 10 years, newspapers will ... and what follows that is make a smart financial, forward thinking financial decision, then reconsider what you're about to say, because that will definitely never happen.
Yeah. I think there's room for this. I'm always looking to see, when I to these places, like, who's on your fraud team? You know, do you have a fraud team yet? If you have a fraud team, I'll take you more seriously, because you understand really what the game of e-commerce is about. And I want to see more of this. But, you know, nothing could work. It'd be like if Google or Amazon was able to do micropayments. If they set up a micropayments thing that said, listen, you can't take these things out, you know, you have to wait 2 months to take these things out because of fraud or whatever. But if it was a brand like Amazon or even Apple or Google, and they did micropayments to be able to pay 2 or 3 cents at a time, would be wonderful. It could change the shape of the internet.
Well, and keep in mind, we're seeing proto versions of that with, like, the way payments are done on YouTube Premium, where these people are not watching ads, but there's sort of they are watching this much of your show. In an alternate reality where they were watching ads, you would be making about this much money. Let us write you a check for that. So really, basically, if there sort of were two internets, one with ads, one with everybody having their premium service, now imagine somebody works out agreements for the universal payment service that aggregates all of their shares of the ads or the premiums, whichever lifestyle consumers wants to live as they randomly encounter your stuff. I mean, on the one hand, I want this to happen. On the other hand, it sounds like an awful lot like the Pollyanna ideas that we heard back in the 90s, and that makes me not very optimistic.
Because all of those people, everyone...
I make a good portion of my income from that model, actually. A good portion of my income comes from Kindle Unlimited. And the way Kindle Unlimited works is you pay X amount of dollars a month, and then I get paid per page read. And because Amazon has such a tight lockdown on their ecosystem of the Kindles, and they're able to... They've had instances of fraud, but they've worked against it. You know, like, you know, you basically, for every page read in the Kindle Unlimited system, I get paid a tiny little fraction of X amount of money that goes into every month. They say there's $20 million in the Kindle Unlimited fund, and however many pages you get is going to get a percentage of that. It's hard for Amazon to be able to monitor that and prevent fraud and stuff. But as far as I know, they do a pretty good job, and I make good money from that. So I've seen in that system, like, that's what I do for publishing but it's all through Kindle. It goes through that world. And if somebody wanted to make an external version of that, fraud. But yeah, I mean, Brian, I think, you know, we've seen it work in small systems there. If we can figure out how to make it work outside. Mm-hmm. Oh, just let me clarify, just the credit, the 2.5%, 2.5%, whatever credit card fee for micropayments. That's exactly the problem. That's why we don't do 3 cents transactions. PayPal had built in a microtransaction structure within there in the early versions of it, which would bypass all that, but that went away sort of. But yes, that's the problem.
Same with Patreon. Sorry. We were able to get a bunch of patrons to pledge just a penny an episode in the early days, and then they yanked on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm about to run out of time. Do we want to jump into picks? Man, my pick is we just finished for the second time The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. Highly recommended. Everybody should read it. You're a good person if you've read it.
Man, I know I watched something. Oh, I liked Rick and Morty. I didn't see the episode last night, but the Rick and Morty episode where Morty gets a dragon. Mm-hmm. There's just some funny stuff, man. These episodes, I just like laughing at them.
This week's Rick and Morty was good. I won't say too much about it, but it kind of feels like they're kind of doing genres this season. So I think they take another genre.
They've always done like takeoffs of certain ideas or movies or television shows or whatever. And the one that I saw that I really liked was the magic versus science, basically. So Rick has to live in the world of magic to complete his quest, and I don't know. There's just it's a very funny, well written show.
Yeah.
I've got a pick. So I mentioned my to do app in Weird Things, and I mentioned during that I have a hydration app. It's called Waterminder. I think it's neat, and it's also another paid app. But what you get for it is a ton of customization. You can set quick, quick things for like, oh, I drink 8 ounces. My glasses at home are 8 ounces, so I can make a quick thing to do that. It has Apple Watch stuff, Apple Health stuff. It's really cool. And if you, like me, are not very good about hydrating, Waterminder is good. Because I think for me, I'm trying to cut back a little bit on soda. And so if I have a thing that reminds me to stay hydrated, then I will replace a lot of that with water. So Waterminder.
Yeah.
I was about to recommend this book, but I don't know. I can't find it on Kindle, and man, I don't know if it still exists outside of like having to pay a lot for a copy. And that was The PayPal Wars, which was all about, you know, kind of like, you know, the formation of PayPal. But if you can't do that, the Elon Musk biography, spend some time going over that. But just the early days of that e-commerce stuff is just fascinating. Of just how much, you know, PayPal realized, oh man, to do this, we'll have to become a bank. I'm like, all right, we'll become a bank. And how do you do that? And, you know, granted, the 90s were crazy times where a lot of things were possible. But it's just very interesting because it just the commerce side of things is what made the internet really work. And it's the thing we struggle with today, but it's a thing that we tend to sort of not want to pay attention to. Hmm. So. Well, everybody, It's been before, now it's after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.